The following audio is from Solid Rock Community Church. More information about Solid Rock Community Church is available at www.solidrockcommunitychurch.com.
But Dave and I, as he said, we've been friends over 20 years now, and always love coming back to Solid Rock. As Dave mentioned, back when we launched Climb for Captive, it was just something that some friends and I did, and one of my friends is here that's climbed with us. He just got injured on a climb recently, so his arm's in a cast, but don't let that discourage you. If you want to come with us, it's very safe. And you guys were right there at the very start of saying, hey, we want to be behind this, and taking a dive into an issue that's a dark issue that a lot of churches don't really want to touch. And thank you for the bravery of Solid Rock and for Pastor Dave and his team of saying, hey, no, let's get into the realness of life and let's see what Jesus has to say about it. As Dave said, I'm with Rescue Freedom International, just an incredible group of people that are out there to free people that have been caught in sex slavery around the world. The reason why we do it is because sex trafficking is now the second largest criminal enterprise in the world. It just passed up arms dealing, so it's right behind drug trafficking. The buying and selling of human beings is actually more lucrative now than all of the money that's made in buying and selling arms, which is incredible. It's a $32.5 billion industry. It's the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the world. Right now, there are more slaves today. 27 million is a conservative estimate. 27 million slaves today, that's more than any other time in human history. More than before the Civil War was fought. And the reality is that it's mainly composed of women. 80% are women, 50% are children. 4.5 million of that 27 million are estimated to be in sex trafficking. And that's the area that particularly we focus on because we feel it's the greatest form of exploitation that a human being can do to another human being. And really, the thing is, it's 98% of it is overseas. So we do have a problem here in the U.S., and we hear about it on the news, and it's quite well advertised here in the U.S., but as big of a problem as is it here, it's even a greater issue overseas. I believe that this issue of trafficking of human life is the Holocaust of our generation. It's the Holocaust of the 21st century. And what's amazing is the church actually has an opportunity here to step into the middle of that darkness and bring hope in only ways that the church is designed to do. We do work in 8 countries. I'll try to get them here. It's the U.S., Spain, Moldova, Tajikistan, India, Bangladesh, Nepal, and we just added Thailand. So we're in 8 countries around the world. We work with 15 different partner organizations. We're a partner-driven model. And those partners together across the globe run 113 different programs. So everything from, you know, night shelters for women that were immediately trying to get off the streets to vocational centers where they're trained on how to have different job skills and get out there with life skills and earn a new income a different way. HIV clinics, safe homes. We have 17 different safe homes around the world. Together, these different partners, we've been able to connect with 38,000 women and children over the course of the last several years. 552 of them are in full-time care tonight. So they're in this long road to recovery after being rescued out of a life of exploitation. And that's a huge, huge part of what we do. I said we work with a partner model. And here's what I mean by that. What's happening as trafficking has grown around the world, people, typically people of faith, have stood up and said, as I hear about this, there's something inside me that nudges me to get involved. And there's something about this thing of serving Jesus that I feel like I have to do something to right this wrong. And people of faith stand up around the world and they usually make an effort to say, I'm going to rescue somebody, I'm going to try to provide safety for this person and care and some kind of restoration. And what we see as that happens is that they realize once they dive into this with all of these great intentions, they oftentimes realize they are in over their head. When you rescue a girl that was trafficked at 13 and for the past 5 years she's been raped up to 30 times a night, the level of trauma that she is dealing with is massive. It's hard to imagine that. And to dive into that without any kind of prior training or ability to navigate that is overwhelming for people. When you bring 3 or 4 of those into a home, it's pretty tough. And that's why we see right now the trend is more safe homes are closing than opening. And so that's why Rescue Freedom has stepped into that and said, okay, the way in which we can best move the needle right now on this issue of human trafficking around the world is come alongside these people of faith that have this incredible heart to say, I want to do something about this. That's the right instinct of the church. And to say, how can we come alongside and help them when they feel like, I haven't slept in years. I haven't gotten, they all have nightmares all night long. I haven't made it through the night yet. And I haven't been able to raise funds. I haven't been able to get out there and help provide income for this. And I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have a PhD in trauma therapy. We can come alongside and breathe new life into those homes. And we have a PhD in trauma therapy that's traveled the world for years. She's a clinical psychologist with a specialist in sexual trauma, and she's trained some of the largest safe homes around the world. She's on our team, and she goes in, she parachutes in and helps these organizations. And I come alongside on the business end of it, and together we're able to bring new life and hope to these people that are providing hope to those that have been so horribly oppressed. That's the business model in a nutshell. That's the essence of what we do. I want to tell you really quick of just one program. There's several things going on, but one that I it's kind of a favorite of mine. It's a project that we called Refuse to Click. There is an interesting connection between pornography and human trafficking. And we realized as 90% of those that had been rescued were telling the safe homes that they were brought into that they had been, during their time of being trafficked, been used to make pornography. We began to realize that there's this massive connection between these two. At least one in five online images, pornographic images online, are of someone who's been trafficked. They're a trafficked victim. And so as people are clicking through online porn, what they're actually doing is producing revenue for those that are actually going out and buying and selling human life. And most are not aware of this. So we created this video. We called it Refuse to Click. It's been translated into several languages. It's now the leading resource used to connect these ideas together of pornography and human trafficking. And we actually are using a Google Ads grant right now to target those who are searching for hardcore porn online. And so every month, thousands of people that are searching for hardcore porn end up watching our video. They're the largest segment of people watching our video right now, hardcore porn users. So that's just one of the examples of some of the things that we do. Everything from rescue to restoration to prevention to empowerment. We're trying to do this around the world in 8 countries right now, and the effort is to launch into every region around the world over the next 3 years because this is organized crime. It's highly connected. So when we've rescued a girl, I was just in Spain, as we rescue a girl in Spain and we get her out, if she is there illegally, and oftentimes she is because she's been trafficked and the Spanish government says, hey, we're going to deport you, if she ends up going back to Nigeria where she's from, then organized crime is texting her photo and her name to one of their people on the ground, and we need to have people on the ground there to pick her up before they do. That's the nature of what we're dealing with. So this movement of saying, okay, let's connect all of these people together to create this interconnectivity, because that's what it's going to take to really move the needle on this issue. For us, it's more than a cause. For us, it's people. And I met one of these individuals when I was in Spain just a short time ago, a safe home in Madrid. Her name was Queen. That was her street name. When Queen was 10, she was walking home from school, little Nigerian girl in a little Nigerian village. She was kidnapped at 10 years old by Boko Haram. They're the same terrorist group you've probably heard back in April of 2014. They kidnapped 250 schoolgirls. I think less than 50 have been recovered at this point. She was kidnapped by Boko Haram. She was forced to be their sex slave in their encampment until she was about 17 years old. At 17, the Nigerian army found their encampment, raided that camp. In the middle of a gun battle, she escaped with her life. She's on the run through Nigeria. A man that she trusted said he would keep her safe, but instead he turned out to be a trafficker as well. And he brought her up through Morocco into Spain, and in Cordoba in the south of Spain, he sold her to a Spanish mafia. She was forced to serve there as a prostituted woman. And in those red light districts, it is gruesome. We call it Gotham. So I spent some time in some of those red light districts. At night, the pimps will put bonfires out in the middle of the streets, and cars will be driving by as if it's like rush hour traffic, but it's 2 or 3 in the morning. These girls will stand by these bonfires trying to keep warm because the pimps don't let them wear anything more usually than their underwear. Guys will drive by shopping. They'll stop, and they'll negotiate a price, and they'll take her away in his car, and he'll rape her for a price and drop her back at that same bonfire a few minutes later. And she'll repeat this 30 times a night. That's what Queen was rescued from 3 months ago. There's something about that when you hear that, if you're human, if there's a heart beating inside your chest, there's something about that you say, that is not right. That is not okay. That has to stop. That's unjust. It's broken. And I get the sense when I read the story of Jesus that he felt the same. I get this sense. I've always been fascinated with Jesus' stated mission whenever he stood up in a Nazareth synagogue 2,000 years ago and he was handed the Isaiah scroll as he was about to announce who he was and what he came to do, that he chose this verse and he said, here's what I'm about. I came to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness the prisoners. What's amazing to me with the story of Jesus is that he says, anyone who believes in me will do what I do. He actually says, who believes in me will do greater things than me in another passage. And the true mark of belief for us as people who claim to follow Jesus is not to say the Billy Graham prayer. The true mark of belief is to do something in the world that resembles the work of Christ. We'll bring hope. We're supposed to feed the poor. We're supposed to heal the sick. We're supposed to set the captive free. That's our calling too. That's the great story that we actually get to live. And for girls like Queen who have been rescued, and they begin to hear about the Christian God, for most of them for the first time ever in the safe home, the one question that they tend to ask is this: what took you so long? It's a tough one to answer. If there are so many followers of God around this world, they're thinking, I'm trying to make sense of this. If what you're saying is true, if there are so many followers of this Christian God around the world, and this God calls his followers into a life that they will set the captive free, that they will do the things that he did here on earth when he was here, that he invites them into this mission to set free the oppressed, if that's true, what took you so long? Where is everybody? See, we tend to see the brokenness of our world, and we tend to point to a lot of good things that are broken and say, that's the reason why. I mean, right now in this season, most of us are pointing to politicians and going, see, that's why this is so broken. Look at them, they're all a mess. We say, man, that's what's wrong with our world. Or we point at the terrorists, and we say, man, see, that is what is wrong with our world. That is exhibit A. But what if that's not true? What if it's on us? Consider just for a second this morning, what if we are the ones that have been given the medicine that has the only hope of healing this world? What if that's true? What if it's true that Jesus is who he said he is? And what if it's true that he invests his power in us to do the things that he did? And what if he chooses to only do those things through his church today? What if that's true? If that's true, then that would mean the reason for the brokenness of our world, the reason why this world is so jacked up, is simply because we have not yet figured out exactly what it means to live as he taught. So let's figure it out. Let's figure out what that would look like. Let's get busy on that, because this would be an incredible life to live, to figure that out and to live in that way, wouldn't it? Are you, hello, are you still hungover from last night? Because some of you are, are you with me? Here we go. I know this is a tough topic, but this is real life. This is what's really going on. It reminds me whenever it snows in Seattle. Whenever it snows in Seattle, life changes for all of us. Have you noticed this? I mean, nobody gets worried whenever there's one little flake, fluttering down. But man, when all the water transforms into snow, everybody freaks out. All the businesses shut down, schools close. They even close at the thought that it might snow. We're just worried about this. And life changes and everybody welcomes it. It's like we forget how to drive all of a sudden, I don't know what to do. There's snow on the ground. And, everybody just shuts down and we start walking around and we're laughing and we're having a good time. Nobody goes to work and we're throwing snowballs at each other. It's amazing to me that that has the power to transform what our existence looks like. Because I think just as individuals, we're just all kind of an individual flake as individuals, but together, like if all of us transform into what we're intended to be, together, we become this avalanche. We have this amazing ability to shut things down. We become this force for good in humanity in a great way. And that, I think, is what Jesus invited us into when he said, you will live in this new kingdom. There will be this new life. You will transform. You will become these people who do as I did. I want to invite you into that. I want to invite you into living your own rescue mission for a world that desperately needs it. That's the life worth living. I'm not talking about all of us going around kicking down doors of a brothel. When I tell stories, particularly the guys in the room are like all ramped up. It's like, I'm going Liam Neeson on this, let's go. Let's take somebody out. I want to punch somebody in the throat. But that's, God really doesn't need our spastic responses to injustice in the world. I think what he needs is our long-term faithfulness. Oftentimes, changing the world for you and for me looks a lot like loving people around us. It looks a lot like living simply and giving extravagantly. It's oftentimes these things that are more difficult for us to do than we realize. And I want to reignite for you a passion to live as Jesus taught, because as all of us do that, our world will change. Slavery will end. Poverty will end. Homelessness will end. Because that's what Jesus designed. Time this morning just for three quick thoughts on what that could look like. I want to nudge us this morning to move from passive to active. Passive to active. If you're taking notes, jot that down. Passive to active. I love the Cinderella story. How many of you are fans of Cinderella? I think there was a new one that came out a few months ago, and it's this classic story. And the moral of the story is basically that someday you will get what you think you deserve, right? It's the reason why people play the lottery with such passion. Someday I will get what I think I deserve. But the American version of Cinderella is different than the historic versions. The American version, she's kind of this victim. Her mother dies tragically. Her father remarries horribly to this wicked woman who has these terrible stepdaughters for her dad. And Cinderella is enslaved, and she does nothing, really. I mean, she just kind of accepts her fate. She sort of wimps around, and she doesn't run away. She doesn't sabotage her captors. She doesn't go carve their hearts out with a steak knife, which is what we're all rooting for her to do. She just sort of takes it. Even when the prince shows up, the guy with the foot fetish, him, you remember this guy. Yeah, he's a real winner. He doesn't care about her character, her beauty, even her hygiene. She's been living in the ash heap or something. And it's like, no, he's just looking for a special foot. And she goes along with this guy. It's like, if that's what he's into, I guess, it'll be fine. Happily ever after? Seriously? We think that's what happened? No. There's a better story here. I prefer any version but that version. In the European versions or the older historic versions, Cinderella is active. She knows exactly who she is, and she actively tries to find her freedom every chance she gets. And I think too many times in our lives, we adopt a passive role in our own stories. We become passive. We wait passively. Even with our faith, begins to amount to singing songs in unison, listening to a great speaker, and then we go home and we wait for the fairy godmother to show up and wave her wand and make it all right. And that's not how this works. While Jesus did come and he did make us right with God, and that's a great part of the story, it's just the first line on the first page. It's the starting line. It's not the finish line. For a lot of us, it becomes the finish line. And I'm going, no, this isn't right. The story is just getting good. God actually invites us. The whole point is that he invites us into an amazing life of making this world into what he envisioned it to be. That's the life that we're invited into. That's where the story starts to get great. The Bible says this: we are created in Christ Jesus to do good works. Yeah, we were saved by grace, but we were created to do good. And we forget that part, but we have to realize that again. We were designed to not be passive. We were designed to be active, created that way. So passive to active, that's the first thing. The second thing is moving from intentions to actions. We have to pivot from intention to action. A friend named Nancy used to work for a home health agency, and she would do checks on patients to make sure that nurses were giving proper care. Several years ago, she was checking on a patient in a poor part of Los Angeles. The neighborhood was run down, it was dirty, but when she pulled into the address, she found this neat little house with a beautiful little garden out front. Family had recently immigrated here from Mexico City. It was a father, a mother, two little boys. One was 7, one was 3. The 7-year-old had been diagnosed 2 years earlier with a very rare disease that was both genetic and fatal, called adrenal leukodystrophy. The mother answered the door, invited Nancy in. The 7-year-old was laying on the couch. He was thin. He was wearing a diaper. He had a feeding tube in his nose. He was his body was so much a skeleton. He was just laying there in the fetal position on the couch, unable to communicate except through a small groan every once in a while. The mother said to Nancy that through her broken English that the doctor believed that her son was now both blind and deaf, and the only way she had to communicate with her firstborn was now through touch. Nancy sat at the kitchen table sipping tea with mom and talking about her son's care. The 3-year-old was playing nearby. Mother showed Nancy the medications they had, and as she was opening the cupboards, Nancy noticed that except for these bottles of medicine, there was really no food in the house. Nancy's heart really went out to this mother, new to the country, very little resources, trying to care for a terminally ill son. She began to ask her about her husband, and she went quiet. Slowly, she shared that 3 weeks earlier, her husband had left. Nancy said, "Well, do you mean he left town? Is he away on work? No, he left. He told me he didn't want to be married to me anymore. 3 weeks ago, they had taken their son to the doctor's appointment, and with this diagnosis, the appointments were never easy, but this one had been particularly difficult. The doctor shared that as best he could determine that their son had 6 weeks left to live. And then he said, I need to talk to you about one other matter. The test results for your 3-year-old have come back, and he too carries the gene for adrenal leukodystrophy. And he will most likely come down with his symptoms within this next year. The mother wept, the father left. And now this mom was virtually alone to care for this 7-year-old boy who was in the final stages of disease that was robbing him of everything it meant to be human. She would bathe him, she would diaper him, she would sing to him and rock him. And at some point in the next few weeks, she would scoop up his lifeless little body off of that couch and put him in a little coffin. And then she would turn around and she would scoop up that 3-year-old playing off the floor. And she would make for him a bed on that same couch. And then over the next few years, she would bathe him and diaper him and sing to him and rock him until that second boy would follow his older brother. Nancy finished up the conversation as best she could, and she drove away from the house. She pulled into a curb a little ways away, a few blocks away, and she just started to cry. Through the tears, she found a blank sheet of paper, and she made a list. She started to write down all the things that she could do to help, all the stuff that she could engage in, and stuff that others could do, the groceries that people could buy, the gas cards that could be bought, the dinners that could be made, babysitting that could be offered. And of everything that she wrote down, what do you think was the first thing that she did? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I don't mean like she did nothing for a couple weeks and then she remembered and then she, like great things happened and there's a great story, you know, great ending. I mean like nothing ever. Never talk to them again. See, intentions are wonderful things if they're the starting point for action. But by themselves, they're nothing. There is no such thing as good intentions. There's only good actions. Faith that is not acted on is actually not faith. The Bible says it like this: faith by itself, if it's not accompanied by action, is dead. God will not say to us, "Well said, good and faithful servant." He won't say, "Great opinions, good and faithful servant. Well thought out arguments, good and faithful servant. Great intentions, good and faithful servant. The commentary we either will or will not hear is well done." It comes down to what we do or do not do. Love isn't measured by words spoken. It's measured by calories burned. And see, when we move away from intentions to action, what actually happens for us as people who follow Jesus, we become the force, this good force in humanity. We become what he had always envisioned us to be and to do. And that's what the church is supposed to be. People around us are supposed to look at the church and go, "Wow, that's what I always thought this world should be about." We're supposed to be like the movie trailer, that when people see us, they go, "Man, I want to be part of that." But oftentimes the things that we're doing don't draw people in. I tell you what, if people see us change these kinds of major issues in our lifetime, they'll be drawn into the story of God like nothing else. But we have to be willing to move away from just intentions, from just talking, to actually getting our hands dirty in doing these things. And the last thing is this. I think we have to move from identity to destiny. So passive to active, intentions to actions, those sound kind of similar. You might have just gotten 2 points. I might have just ripped you off this morning. You might have only got 2 points this morning. The last one is this. Identity to destiny. I was speaking at a men's conference in Bellevue a while back, and I was given the delightful topic of speaking on the connection between pornography and human trafficking. So as if one of those topics isn't dark and difficult enough, let's mash them together and just totally depress everybody in the radius of the room here. So I was talking to a guy afterwards that had endured the whole workshop, and he was talking to me, and he was complaining. He was, "Man, I'm a sinner. I feel like I sin a lot. I have this tendency to sin, particularly this one sin, and I'm sinful because I have this sin nature, and I feel like I have this nature because I'm evil, and all of this, and I just can't see my way forward to do good in this world because I'm a sinner." I was just banging my head against the wall. I was depressed listening to him. And his belief system that he had set up for himself was so perfectly designed so that he would always fail. I felt bad for him. He was a newer Christian, and the model of Christianity that he had kind of bought there had given him all sorts of new things to feel guilty about. And instead of propelling him to the mission of God, it actually caused him to sit on the sidelines and to feel like he was something other than what he was really intended to be. I don't think that that's what Jesus had in mind. I don't think Jesus looks at him and goes, "Yes, that's what I bled and died for." No. It's not at all what Jesus intended. You see, the first Christians insisted that whenever we say Jesus is Lord, that whenever we invite Jesus into our lives, that a profound shift takes place in our identity, in who we are. They believed that this person that we used to be in that moment dies, and that we're given a new self, a totally new nature, that we now have a completely different way in which to be human. And it's not that we're perfect now or this old person won't come back from time to time. It's that this new way of life involves a constant conscious decision to keep dying to our old self so that we will keep choosing to live in the new self. That's really what's going on. A wise teacher once said, if people were taught more about who they are, they wouldn't have to be told what to do. That it really comes down to who we are, our identity, if we understood that. The point is not trying to convince yourself not to sin. The point is to understand who you now are. Paul wrote to the church, "Therefore, as God's people, holy and dearly loved." These are the kinds of things that Paul wrote that we usually just skip over. But I want you to catch something that he says here. He says you are holy. You, me, total sinners, that we're holy. It's not that we're going to be holy someday. It's not, wouldn't it be nice if you were holy? Too bad you're still such a loser, but let me write this letter so you can figure it out. No, it's not what he's saying. He's saying, you are holy. This is who you are now. His plan doesn't involve me beating myself up over the things that I'm not doing. His plan is learning who this person is that God insists that I already am. That's his plan for you and me. So what do I do when I follow my old self instead of this new self? Admit it, confess it, thank God that I'm already forgiven, make amends with anybody that's been affected, and then you move on. You keep going. It's not because sin isn't serious. It's because we have to take more seriously who we are already. But that's the more serious issue. The point isn't my failure. It's God's success in remaking me. That's what this is all about. God is retelling our story through Jesus. And I have to decide each day which story I'm going to live in. Is it God's story about me or some story that I have made up about myself? Because that determines my identity. And my identity determines my destiny. It determines where I go and what I do in this world. And that's why this is important when we talk about human trafficking. Because unless we as the church begin to recognize our identity of what God has set us up to do in this world, we will fail to achieve it. Speaking of identity, there's an interesting story of there's 7 billion people in the world right now. Only 13 million of them are Jewish. So it's this tiny group of people within our world. But what fascinates me is that percentage-wise, this small group of people have earned more Nobel Prizes and Pulitzer Prizes, and they've contributed more to business and society and art and culture than any other group. And there's a lot of studies as to why that would be so. And the point that they point to oftentimes as they make these studies is what happens in Jewish homes when a father tells his children the story of the Jewish people. He tells them this over and over and over again. It becomes, they believe, that individual's identity. And the reason why the Jewish people has contributed so greatly to humanity is because they don't have to spend the first 30, 40, or 50 years of their life trying to figure out who they are. It's handed to them. Their identity is given to them, so they're freed up to make a difference in this world. And that's the same for you and I. God hands you your identity. You don't have to spend all of this energy and time trying to figure out why you're not this and why you're not that and what am I going to do. It's given to you. So let's go out and use it to have an incredible destiny to make a difference in the world. That's the whole point. As followers of Christ, your identity is handed to you. Queen, I mentioned earlier, it's not where her story ends. The story of Queen continues, and Queen was telling this story just a couple months ago now for the first time. She had been rescued for only 3 weeks, just been out of the red light district for 3 weeks. And at that point, she finally felt safe enough to tell this director at the safe home exactly what she had been through since she was 10 years old. And in the room, I was sitting outside. We were just getting ready to go into the red light district that night, into Gotham. And Queen started to open up to this story, and another girl there was Beauty. And we'd asked her to come in because Queen said, hey, I want to talk to you about what I've been through, where I've been. And for many girls, this is their first step into freedom, to actually talk about what's happened to them. Beauty came in. Beauty was 3 years ahead of where Queen was at. She was also Nigerian. Very similar story. She'd been abducted from Nigeria, transferred into Spain. In our Spain safe home, there's 3 continents represented, 8 different countries. None of them are from Spain. They're all trafficked in. So Beauty was there, and she was listening in on this conversation and kind of interpreting because Queen's English was not that great. And Beauty had just really the night before introduced us to her new husband. She had gone through the program there in that safe home. She now had a great job. She'd been married just over a year. I met her husband. He was a pastor in Madrid there. Beauty was HIV positive after many years of being exploited, but she's expecting her first child. And through medication, they can bring the baby out without it having this HIV infection. And what we wanted to convey to Queen is that you are just 3 years away from this. This is your future. This is your destiny. This is now who you are. This is the course of your life, that there will be a day where you'll be able to sit back right here just like Beauty, and you'll be able to help a girl that's just been rescued, just like this. It was interesting listening to Queen talk, and she was asked by the director as she finished telling her story, is there anything you remember about your home, anything you remember about growing up? And she said, I remember this one thing. I remember what my mom and dad called me. It's not my street name. Queen's my street name. They called me Joy. That's who I was. And that's who I am. And that's what I want you to call me from this night forward. That's my new identity. You know, we need help rescuing a lot of girls like Joy. There's 4.5 million of them out there right now. And they're asking, why haven't you come yet? And I think we can give them a better response. I think we can come back with saying, yeah, we're coming. We're on our way. We're recognizing who we are and who we're supposed to be. And you know, just a couple quick practical things here. I need to close with this, but just three practical ways, I think, in which you can get involved. Sometimes we talk about this, people are like, okay, I'm ready to go. Let's do this. What do we do? Here's what we do. Here's the game plan. First thing is this. We need people to be a voice. We need people to be a voice. Modern forms of slavery happen all around us. And although as a culture we look at that and most people go, okay, this is wrong, this is evil, we have not hit the cultural tipping point where this will end for us, even here in this country. And we're at the leading edge in our global community. We need to figure out how to hit the tipping point before everybody else. And here's what I mean by this. Jimmy Fallon, in his monologue just a few weeks ago, and I love late night, love Jimmy Fallon, but he made a joke about the fact that Asian manufacturer had replaced much of its workforce with robots, but just to keep it real to life, they were making them child robots. He was making a joke about child slave labor. And as long as that is acceptable in our culture, we have not hit the tipping point where we are willing to put this down. Something is not yet achieved. As long as slavery is a punchline, it won't be abolished. I bet that people in the early 1800s in this country, I bet that slavery was a punchline. I bet people were joking about it. But something happened by the mid-1800s. Something took place. There was a pivot. And no longer were people willing to laugh. They were willing to pick up guns and fight for what they believed to be right and true. People like Harriet Beecher Stowe, a great Christian woman, wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Different things like that began to shift the public mindset to say, wait a second, I understand what's going on. I've heard these stories. And I know how heinous this is. And that is not funny. I will not laugh at that. I think as long as, you know, in our country, if somebody dressed up like a slave owner for Halloween from the 1800s, that would be repulsive. I think our people around us would say, that is heinous, that is wrong. So why is it funny for someone to dress up like a pimp? Because it's the exact same thing. It's the modern equivalent. They're just a slave runner today. We can't be more concerned as a church if someone's dressed up like a ghost or goblin. This stuff is wrong and it's happening in front of us and we laugh. I'll tell you what, 3 weeks ago, I was encouraged because someone in the audience at late night booed Jimmy Fallon. And it caught him off guard. He didn't know what to do, poor guy. He didn't realize that he had just fallen on the wrong side of history on a horrible issue. But with that booing, hope began to rise in me that there are people who get this and they're willing to stand up and recognize it for what it is and say that it's wrong. And we need to do that more. As a church community, we are the ones that oftentimes can guide our culture into health and wholeness and hope. And we need to be a voice for what's right. So be a voice. I think another real practical thing here is just being willing to lend a hand to the vulnerable. Step into those that are most at risk. Right now, the most at-risk kids are from foster care. It's the foster care system. In talking to, you know, our partners, over 70% they're telling us that they are rescuing come from the foster system. Over 70% of those that are trafficked are coming from the foster care system. Right now, we know of pimps that are trolling local DSHS offices, watching for girls that they feel are being neglected so that they can take advantage of them. That's what's going on. And right now in Washington State, as 10,000 kids are in the foster care system, 2,000 are awaiting adoption. They're open, they're waiting for someone to say that they want them. But nobody's taking them. And that's why they're vulnerable. And as long as we have traffickers that will tell them that they're wanted, we will have slavery. As long as there are kids who are saying, I'm ready for someone to help me, to love me, to take me. And as long as traffickers are ones that will step up before the church and say, yeah, you're wanted, we will have slavery. We need people that will say, I'm going to step into this. For me, my faith compels me to do more. And I'm willing to step into this. There's a whole spectrum of ways that people can help out. There's all kinds of things. Some of you are saying, foster care, I don't know if that's me. It may not be you. Adoption may not be you, but there's other ways that you can step into this. There's programs like Safe Families and Helping Hands and CASA where you can come alongside a foster family and help them do the work that they're doing. There's programs like Boys and Girls. Being a big brother and a big sister, oftentimes targeted towards foster kids or at-risk kids, that is a huge step for these kids to hear someone cares about me. That's massive. There's some friends here, Kyle and Rachel. Can you guys just wave really quick? Kyle's got one good hand there. He's waving. They're foster parents. They're friends of mine. Big part of what we do at Rescue Freedom. And they volunteered this morning to say, hey, I'd be happy to come. And if anybody is saying, I would love to talk to somebody, just what does that even mean? What would that look like? Because if you've tried to move into the foster care system, it's kind of a gap. There's a chasm there of saying, well, I'm interested. Well, it's like, well, go to this 10-hour seminar on Saturday to figure out if this is a fit for you. And so there's a lot of gap there where people fall through. Kyle and Rachel said, hey, we'd be happy to talk to people and help you get a sense for if this might be a fit for your family or not. And I think the last thing here, ways to get involved, is very simple, is give. A lot of people go, well, I mean, isn't there, like, what else? I mean, like, I know I can give, I know I can pray, but what else? Well, don't skip over that one so fast. Particularly when it comes to international issues, giving is probably one of the biggest things that we can do. I got an email from our partner in Calcutta. 12 more girls were rescued. And to keep them out of the brothels, that's another $2,000 a month that we're saying, okay, we're gonna send two grand more a month into Calcutta to make sure those girls stay out of the red light district. And so we're looking for people to help. It's 60 more people giving $30 a month. It's $142 a month to provide holistic care for a girl that's been rescued. That's what it takes for all of the health care and psychological care, all those different things. That's what's involved. So I have a little buddy named Hamish that gives $4 every month. I think that's most of his allowance. But he's a rabid abolitionist, and he's going to make a difference, and he is. This is what drives it. This is what helps us be able to do this work. So if you can help us, rescuefreedom.org is our website, and we'd love to see you step in to this with us and help us out. And not to take away from anything that you're doing here at church, because this is important. The work that you're doing here is where it all begins. I know this is a dark topic. Dave, thanks for letting me come and share not just some of the stories of what's going on, but really challenge you to say, let's do something. Let's get involved. Let's be engaged. This is what the church is all about. I know many of you are probably listening to this and you're saying, hey, we're a mobile church. I'm doing. I mean, this is every Sunday we're doing. It takes all of you, I know, to make this happen. And I don't want you that are engaged and you're active and you're doing stuff right now to feel like, oh, great, another thing about it. I've got to do more. Who I really want to speak to for those that are in neutral, for those of you who are saying, yeah, I've kind of been sitting on the sidelines. In 2008, and I spoke here shortly after this, I first heard about human trafficking. And I remember going to bed that night thinking, man, I wish I could back up the clock and erase what I now know. But I couldn't. And that's the spot that I've intentionally placed you in today. You're welcome. The thing is this, you can choose to ignore this or you can choose to take action. But you will never be able again to say, I did not know. Right? Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for designing us in such a way that you made us to do something significant in this world. You designed us to make a difference, Lord. You've designed us, you've saved us by grace for a great purpose. And so, Lord, I pray that you would help us to capture that. Some right now, they're engaged in that. They're already doing that. But for many this morning, they would not be able to say that I have uncovered this destiny that Jesus has designed me to fulfill. And so as a church, Lord, I pray that you would activate us again. I pray that you would breathe by your Spirit into our hearts, that we would sense something within us rising up to say, I will be a force for good. And it will start with the simple things. It will start with conversation. It will start with what I'm doing and what I'm giving and how I'm living. Lord, that you would begin to move us forward to be this force for good in our world that you have designed your church to be. Lord, it's incredible to see the great things that are happening here at Solid Rock. You're using this church in great ways. But Lord, I pray that you would fan that flame to even greater things in the days ahead. And we pray that in the name of Jesus. May it be so. Amen. Amen. Hey, thanks, bro.